Welcome to Hacker Public Radio. Today we're talking about the basics of RF. Hello and welcome to Hacker Public Radio. Today we're going to talk about radio frequencies and radio. How does it work? My call sign's W3RAZ, and I'm also known as Gorkon from the Linux Link Tech Show. Ken graciously has allowed, well, a lot of us to actually put shows out on the Hacker Public Radio feed, and he actually asked the question if I can cover it, and I want to try and cover this to the best of my abilities. And that is, what is RF exactly? What's radio frequencies? How does it work? And some basics that you may need to understand if you decide to go and take the amateur radio exam. Now, the next show I record, I will detail from the U.S. aspect on what you need to do to get your amateur radio license. So first off, what is radio frequencies, or what is radio? Well, if you see a light bulb near you, or a television, or anything that produces light, you're actually looking at radio. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, radio, quite simply, is an electromagnetic transmission that is radiated from an antenna. And I'll get to more about some of that as we go further in. So what happens is radio frequencies, radio is essentially light. That's why, it is also guided by the speed of light. Your transmission is not going to go any faster than C, or the speed of light. Now, I'm getting a little bit deeper into the physics than I wanted to, but basically, that's really what it is. And how they ended up coming up with radio. Remember, I talked about spark gap transmitters. And basically, all they had to do was turn a sine wave on and turn a sine wave off. That's really all they did. And Morse code was decided by short sine waves and long sine waves. So it's a combination of those that make up a character. So it's really that simple. Now, the way a phone or conventional radio that most people are used to is how it works is you have like a microphone, which a microphone is essentially the same thing as a speaker. It's definitely not exactly the same, but it essentially, for all intents and purposes, is. There's a diaphragm that vibrates as you talk and moves back and forth as your voice comes out of your mouth, and then translates that into an electrical signal. Now, in radio, at least conventional one methods of radio that we're used to, most radio is analog. Now, there is digital radio, and I'm not going to get too far into that because I really don't have any of those. But it operates on the same principle. How it vibrates its diaphragm is different. So with radio, what happens is that signal that you're getting from the microphone will then do what we call modulate a sine wave. Now, most people have heard of what AM and FM. Those are both forms of modulation. Modulation can occur in pretty much two different modes. First one that was first invented was amplitude. So basically what happened is the sine wave would be modulated in the amplitude of the signal. By amplitude, I mean that louder your voice would be, the bigger the sine wave, the lower your voice would be, the smaller your sine wave. And the sine wave that you're modulating is what's called a carrier. Now, in the bandwidth terms, when you look at an AM signal, it actually is very wide compared to the next one I want to talk about, which is single sideband. So an AM signal is essentially consists of what they call two sidebands. And because radio spectrum is finite, in the basic sense of the term, it's finite. There's only so much radio spectrum that's usable. And I say usable because the spectrum actually is infinite, but you can't use, for worldwide communication, you cannot use a high frequency like a microwave frequency. It's not going to work. And why that is, I'll get to that later on in the episode here. But sideband was invented because the AM signals took up so much space. So they basically lopped off a sideband, either the upper or the lower. And then that's how they were able to conserve bandwidth and let more stations use the spectrum that was given. Now, there's a lot of physics involved in the circuitry and the ciprohexadiene receivers and all that stuff. But I'm not really getting into that. I'm talking very basics. If you want to get deeper into this, you're going to have to go to some of the sites. I want to hopefully have some sites to pop in the show notes. And you can go ahead and check those out. So, now, the next mode is a mode that, or the next kind of modulation is what most people listen to now if they listen to radio, especially if you're listening to music, and that's frequency modulation. So basically your voice then modulates the frequency of the carrier. Now, you actually have, I don't really think there is a upper sideband, lower sideband. There probably is, but we usually don't worry about that on FM because you're usually using, where I use FM most commonly is on the VHF or very high frequency band, that's 2 meters in the amateur radio, or UHF, and that's 70 centimeters. So, but that's the basics of both amplitude and frequency modulation. And a little bit about sideband, single sideband. So, essentially, in a voice mode, that's your voice is modulating that carrier. The carrier is cycling, and they actually, in the old days of my grandfather, they actually used to call that, like instead of a kilohertz or a megahertz, it's called a kilocycle or a megacycle. So, then Heinrich, I think it's Heinrich, anyway, Mr. Hertz then discovered some things, and then they named it after him. That's why it's called megahertz. Anyway, so your carrier is cycling at the rate that you tune your transceiver to. For example, if you're talking to a repeater that receives on, and I'll get into repeaters in a bit. If it receives on 147.24 or 147.24 megahertz, that's your carrier. Now, your voice is going to actually go beyond that. That's where the sidebands come into play there. So, I just wanted you to understand that even though you are tuning at 147.24, you're not actually only passing information on that frequency. You actually expand past that. So, that's why single sideband was invented. It's because, like I said, it allowed more people to use the given frequencies. So, now, one little sidebar here. I'm actually recording this with a handheld recorder as I walk along to the bus stop this morning. And I just wanted to give you a reason why I'm doing that. As emergency communications is part of amateur radio, we often have to work in conditions that are not ideal. We often work, you know, on the side of a road or out in the rain, in a camp, whatever, you know. Excuse me. Anyway, that's why I decided to record this episode with a handheld mic, and why I will record some future episodes. I try not to do too many of them because I know that the noise can be a little distracting. But one thing I do want you to know is why emergency communications is at the forefront of having an amateur radio license. And it should be one, not the only reason you get your license. You should have fun doing it too. But it should be a big reason. You know, you want to have a good way that you as a hacker or a geek can serve the community. Amateur radio is a perfect hobby to serve the community. A lot of times people won't understand what us hackers work on, but they do understand you being able to hook up a desperate person who's lost their relatives, say in Joplin, Missouri, or Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They can, amateur radio operators can hook you up with those and get those important status messages in and out of the area. So, sidebar over. So, back to the basics of radio frequency. So, talked a little bit about AM, FM, what an RF signal is. So, let's talk about what you need to actually transmit one and detect one. Now, most people now, instead of buying just a receiver or just a transmitter, we'll buy a transceiver. Transceiver does exactly what you would think. It's a combination of transmitter and receiver. So that's why they call it a transceiver, because it can do both. Now, each aspect of a radio is different. The receiving aspect is definitely a little bit different than the transmitting aspect, but in the basic sense of the term, the circuits are actually not all that different. So for a receiver, you need far less attention to some things that you do a transmitter. Now, a critical piece is the antenna. Now, for a receive antenna, you don't really need have an antenna that is tuned to the receiving frequency. It helps, but it's not really needed. You can attach your radio, your receiver, to a piece of metal, and that will act as an antenna and absorb the radio frequency and then convert that to audio. And essentially the opposite method of you converting your voice to an RF wave. So, a receiver basically will use that antenna to absorb and pick up the received frequency, produces it audio. the very basics. A very simple receiver is, if you ever, if you're my age, I don't know if they do this anymore, but if you're my age, one of the things you might have done in science class was build a crystal radio. And a crystal radio is a very simple receiver. It consists of mainly of three parts. A earphone, a coil, and then, well, actually, four parts. A earphone, a coil, a diode, and an antenna. The main circuit in question here is the diode. Well, it's not really a circuit so much as it's a component. But the diode is at the very central, when you combine it with the coil, which is an inductor, special inductor, it has to be, you have to have access to the coils, because that's how you're going to tune the radio. Okay? And without those other parts, that diode can't do its job. But you don't even need a battery with a crystal radio, because basically what happens is the antenna picks up the RF, and then the diode converts that into an electrical signal that then vibrates the earphone. So if you want some, like a fun project that you can do, a very simple project that you can do with your kids, look up how to build a crystal radio. Now, I can see if I can put a link in the show notes. But, a crystal radio is a very crude receiver. And it doesn't have the what they call selectivity of a modern transceiver. Selectivity means you are only concerned with the signal that's modulating around the carrier that you're tuned to. And you want to reject anything else. So, the more selective a radio is, the more sensitive it is to picking up weak signals. So, what is needed for a transmitter? Well, basically the reverse of a receiver. You need a microphone, a method to modulate the carrier, and an antenna. And an antenna in a transmitter is far more critical than it is in the receiver. The antenna in a transmitter has to be tuned to be able to resonate at the frequencies that you want to resonate at. Now, usually, the most basic antennas amateurs start out with is a quarter wave antenna. Now, it can be a whip, it can be a dipole, and a dipole, what a whip is, or a vertical, whip or vertical, is a, essentially, it's a wire that's cut to a certain length. For example, quarter wavelength, 2 meter antenna, it's probably going to be around 19 inches long, give or take. Now, the further away it is from resonance means you get something what they call a standing wave. A standing wave will actually work to reduce the amount of signal that your antenna is radiating. Now, what we call the standing wave ratio is a ratio that's measured with a special piece of equipment, an SRW meter, or SWR meter, I'm sorry. Anyway, a good standing wave ratio is 2 to 1. Okay? You put out 1 watt, like a good example is you put out one, this is greatly simplified, but you put out 1 watt for every 2 that you put in. Perfect, as in 100%. 100% of that 2 watts would be 1 to 1. Anything higher than a 2, you're really starting to lose a lot of your transmission, and therefore your range. The more power that you transmit, the closer you are to that 1-to-1 ratio, the more power you're going to transmit, the further your signal will go. So, in order to have an antenna, you're going to want to look at quarter waves, half waves, and very, very rarely a full wave antenna. Now, a full wave antenna is essentially exactly the it's the same, basically this has the same bandwidth as your, the same width as your signal. All right, so if a 144 megahertz antenna is 19 inches at a quarter, imagine how large that the antenna will be at a full wave. That's why you're not using full wave antennas mostly. So, and then we actually can get for even further into it. Take a dipole antenna. A dipole is essentially two pieces of wire, one going on each side of the feed point. And each of those wires, well, I'm trying to remember how it's been a while since I built a dipole. But basically, your dipole is cut to a certain bandwidth, to a certain wave. And one antenna that is an improvement upon that dipole design is called the Yagi antenna, which was invented by, I'm trying to remember, the last name of him was Yagi, and that was a Japanese name, Yagi Uda. And it's basically two amateurs in Japan. And what they do is they take different lengths of wire or metal, excuse me, and they put one behind the dipole. So, for example, in a vertically polarized antenna, all of your conductors are going to go up and down. In a horizontally polarized, they're going to be basically flat against the earth. Not against the earth, you know, it'll be up on a pole, but. So in a vertically polarized, it's perpendicular to the earth. That might be a little bit easier to understand, I think. But anyway, they put two conductors on either side of that dipole. One conductor is larger than a dipole. The other conductor is smaller than a dipole. And there's a whole lot of math involved with this. Fortunately, a lot of that has been figured out for us by some companies that, you know, see interest in money-making opportunities in making these antennas. So you can generally buy one for, I probably paid about $40, $50 for my antenna, my Yagi antenna. But what does that do? What do those things do with that antenna? Well, the element behind that goes, what I would say behind, the larger element, is what they call the reflector. And the one on the other side of the antenna is called the director. All right? And essentially, the reflector reflects signal in one direction, and the director helps direct that same signal in the direction that basically your antenna is pointing. So basically, a Yagi antenna is a way to give your radio signal some direction. And it's basically, after vertical and a dipole antenna, it's probably the next one that a lot of people look at. They can get far more complicated than that, but the basics of antenna manufacturing and making your own antenna is very, very, very same. Very much simple, I should say. Alright. So, I've heard a little bit about AM, FM, sideband, radio frequency. What is it? How do you receive it? How do you transmit it? Now, what do you do with it? Well, you communicate. And there are many modes. You know, a lot of modes that we already talked about. There's AM, FM, sideband. And those are but all what they call phone modes, you know, because I think back in the day, they actually used something that looked like a phone. Oh, and one important thing I forgot is back in the early times of radio, you didn't buy a transceiver, you bought a receiver and you bought a transmitter, so you had to buy both. So you essentially back then probably had to have two antennas. Fortunately now with a transceiver, you only have to have one antenna. So that's a good thing. But so as radios themselves got a little bit more complicated, some of the other things got a little more simple. So what, like I said, what can we do with this stuff? Well, you can have a conversation with your friend. Talked to very many people over the years. 2013 will be my 20th year as an amateur radio operator. And I've just had a good time just chatting. That's my favorite mode right now. And it's what they call an analog mode. Digital voice modes, very similar to voice over IP technology like Asterisk. They exist, however, the downside to those modes right now is very few. There's not really a standard, I guess is what I want to say. The standards are mostly manufacturer driven, the standards of those modes right now. For example, ICOM, which is a Japanese amateur radio company, they have something called D-Star. And then I'm trying to think if Kenwood has their own standard. Or Kenwood is I thought Kenwood was an American company, but I think they are now Japanese as well. Most of the companies are Japanese or Chinese companies. Or out of Taiwan, like Yaesu. I think Yaesu is Chinese or Japanese also. But hey, man, digital modes for voice, they're a little rare. Most voice communication on the amateur bands are still happening over analog frequencies. TV may have gave it up, but radio has not. They have not given up the analog stuff. So now the one unique thing with amateur radio is there still are digital modes that are different than phone or voice over, you know, digital voice modes like D-Stars. For example, there are on the 2 meter and VHF UHF frequencies, there's something that's called packet radio. Packet radio will take a digital packet and it uses the ones and zeros to modulate that signal in a certain way and then transmits it on the hand bands. Then on the receiver side, they pick the same signal up using same concepts, and then it converts it back to the digital bytes so that you can read it on your computer screen. That's greatly simplified. But if you want to look at an idea of what packet radio is like, go back to the old days of your modem. Because essentially, that's what a terminal node controller is. That's what you use to hook up. That's basically what you hook up to your radio in order to use packet radio. Now, the old ones used to use purely a serial cable, because it is a serial mode. And new ones, there are devices that basically let you use your sound card and software as a TNC. Now, it's more efficient to use and kind of cool to use a regular terminal node controller, because a terminal node controller in many ways is a computer. It usually has a processor on it. It has some memory for storage. And basically, if you wanted to leave your transceiver on all day, because the terminal node controller has your call sign plugged into it, that makes it legal. So you can leave that on all day, even though you're not necessarily at the control point. you're still within the legal bounds. As long as you can get to that receiver or that station and turn off that radio, you're still in control. Anyway, you can leave that terminal node controller and the radio on all day, and people can actually send messages that would arrive on your terminal node controller, and there will be a little message light that lights up, and you log into a like a terminal program. You'd hit the serial port and talk to the terminal node controller, and then get your packet email. And there is even the ability with packet radio to send an email to somebody all the way other on the other side of the United States. And I was doing this before the internet really came into play. So that's one way amateur radio continues to just kind of move on and do things. And a lot of times it seems a little bit archaic, but you got to remember, in some of these cases, amateur radio operators themselves invented the mode and came up with it. Like, for example, the APRS, or Automatic Position Reporting System, which is another use of packet radio, that was invented by WA4 APR Bob Bruninga. And the original APRS program was written on DOS. There is, of course, Windows APRS programs. There's a Linux one called Xaster, and then there's also a Mac one called Mac APRS. I think that Mac APRS still exists. And then there's also a Java-based APRS program called Java APRS. You can also view APRS maps on the internet. So, in fact, I've got a program on my phone. Well, I can get a program for my phone called APRS Droid. And basically, I can get my phone out and I can look at the APRS map. I think it will even actually somehow, I don't know exactly how, but digipete my position with my cellular. Now, cellular phones, there really is no analogy in amateur radio to cellular phones. There's no cellular phone that I know of that operates on the amateur radio bands. Now that I mentioned cellular phones, there, one important thing that you need to remember, and I actually had somebody right after my first show ask about this, but he asked if there was a way that he could receive, hold on a minute, this is what I call, talking about non-ideal situations, anyway, he asked me if he could actually receive the internet using an amateur radio. Well, technically, it's very possible, but because we're limited in bandwidth, right now, the maximum packet bandwidth that we can use is 9600. That's slower than your old 14.4 modem, slower than your 28.8 modem, all right? So it's not going to be very usable for modern-day internet, not like your phone is. There's also a different aspect to that, because there's this thing that we'll get into a little bit when we talk about the licensing, called a pecuniary interest. Basically, you cannot make money you can make money selling things for amateur radio, but you cannot make money as a result of your amateur radio license. I.e., if you want to transmit a message for somebody to a disaster area, you can't take money for it. If there's an amateur radio operator that works anywhere in the company, there's these things, we'll talk a little bit later, I'll probably do a special show on repeaters, be a little bit shorter than this one. But there's this thing called an auto patch. Basically, it's a way that you can make a phone call via amateur radio. Now, in a disaster situation, you can call a pizza place and order pizza for the people at your location, okay? But only in a disaster situation. For example, if I'm on my way home, I whip out my radio to order a pizza, because there might be a person that works for Donato's or for whoever I'm ordering pizza from that may have an amateur radio license, that would be an illegal transmission. Same thing goes for the internet, you know, because there's a chance that somebody who is an amateur radio operator could be making money as a result of your transmission on the internet over amateur radio. Then you basically cannot do it. Plus, you're also not allowed to use potty mouth on amateur radio bands because kids listen to it. Kids can go. I think the youngest kid I've heard of with an amateur radio license was 7. Okay, what I covered today was a lot of technical information. Some of it should be correct. A lot of it should be correct. And if I made any mistakes, let me know. You can email me at gorkin@gmail.com, or you can also email me at gorkin@tllts.org. Thank you for listening. I'm actually recording this live at the booth, the LinuxLink Tech Show booth at Southeast Linux Fest. By the time this comes out, you have missed the show. Hopefully I might. Well, just listen to TLLTS, and we'll definitely have a show or two out that we record down here. So I want to thank you listening to Hacker Public Radio. Got a lot of good comments on the last show. Keep listening to Hacker Public Radio. I'm going to have some more information on amateur radio and Linux and whatever else I decide to record. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. For more information on the show and how to contribute your own shows, visit hackerpublicradio.org.